Okay, so one of the things, relapse, and that sort of fits into the first physical aspect, first part, sort of the physical recovery. You know, I was thinking about the running thing, and there's a lot of analogies for me between this running method I adopted and abstinence in the program and working the program.
My turn's on.
So this guy started this program of running because he kept getting injured. And one of the things, it's a walk run. So, you know, most people just run. And they run 26.2 miles, and then they're exhausted at the end. And he discovered that to run faster, to take walk breaks. And so, you know, his fastest time was 2 hours and 12 minutes. So he's a fast runner. And he discovered that he shaved about 10 minutes off of his time by taking a walk break every 10 minutes. And so he developed this method, and basically he says, you know, if you can walk, I'll have you running a marathon in 6 months and finishing and completing one. And I was like, oh, okay. And so I began doing this, and I actually went to his camp, and it was fascinating what he talked about. And I think that this is where the recovery is, because I think when I come into the program, okay, I've got to do it all. Got to get an abstinent, get a sponsor, work the stats, do everything, go. And one of the things he said is there's two types of training when you go running. He goes, you've got to train for distance, and you have to train for speed. So when you go running, you know, in the morning, and you do a short run, let's say run for 30 minutes or run for 40 minutes, you're going to try and run a little bit faster. And he'll give you some exercises for running faster, such as count how many steps you take in a minute. Maybe you run 30 steps in a minute. Well, maybe you try to go for 35 steps in a minute. And these little exercises to make you go faster. And that's where you work on your speed, is on the short runs. And on the long runs, what you really want to work on is endurance, running distances. So just run as slow as you possibly can, because running, speed-wise, doesn't help you with endurance. So on a long run, would you run 5, 10, 15, 20 miles? Because you could practically walk that. But instead, you want to run very slowly, because you want to conserve your energy and preserve your body, so when you're running next the following week, you're not so tired out that you've injured yourself and make things worse. And so he goes, there's really two training techniques. One, short distances to work on speed. Long distances to work on endurance. And his idea was that, you know, also taking walk breaks will improve your speed. You'll run faster by taking walk breaks. And that was true. It's certainly been borne out. It was true for me. And I remember going to talk to him, and I said, well, you know, I'm running. I've, you know, been able to finish a marathon in 4.5 hours, which is okay, time-wise, nothing spectacular. But I really want to break 4 hours. And I'm really doing the speed training that you have in your book and working on that. And, I'm just hitting a certain point. And he said, do the speed training for one race and then stop. It's like, okay. He said, look, you're not going to win any medals. You're not going to break any world records. And people who try and run for speed, they get burned out. And they stop. And they drop out of all exercise and marathoning. Mm-hmm. And he goes, the idea is to have fun. So do that speed training once, and then drop it. And then just run at your own pace and enjoy it, and you'll stay with running much longer. Because who cares whether you run a marathon in 4.5 hours or 5 hours? It's you. No one else cares. Mm-hmm. Take 6 hours, whatever it is. It doesn't matter. It's about being in the moment and enjoying it. And I thought, huh. And that really was very profound for me. And how do I often, how long in the beginning of the program did I go on this, like, race? Let me do all the work. Let me show up at all the workshops. Let me do the writing. And I burned myself out. You know, I'm doing, for short periods of time, I need to be very intensive. But for the longer periods of time, if I'm going to be in the endurance game and be here a long time, I got to slow down my pace. And that doesn't mean slough off, but that does mean to pace myself. So maybe I'm not going to do it perfectly. Maybe I'm not going to get through all the 12 steps in my first year. Maybe it means I'm not going to be at goal weight for a couple of years. Because I'm going for the endurance. You know, and the people who go for the speed to get it done, they don't stay with it. I mean, there are those few that love speed, love running. They start breaking records. They do amazingly well. There is a very famous story about a woman, Sister Jean. She was a nun in her mid to late 40s who had never run. And she ran her first marathon and won it. And she taught little kids. And she's the oldest woman to ever qualify at the Olympics. And, I mean, just out of nowhere. Yeah, there she was literally born to run. And but there are very, very few people who are that way. And same with abstinence and working the program. There are very few people that go right out of the shot, get abstinent, do all the 12 steps, keep working, and just work at an incredibly high level and pace and stay in the program. And part of the thing which leads me to talk about relapse, I've certainly relapsed. And I think part of the thing with relapse and coming out, you know, trying to get out of that relapse and back in recovery is I want to do that long, hard run. And part of it is a punishment. Part of it's to make up for lost time. Part of it knows that I'm way behind everybody else and I've got to catch up somehow. Not that there's a race, but in my mind there is. And so I got to delve into the steps. I got to get into super, super, super strict abstinence. And I'm going to just work this thing and get back on track. And that usually lasts about 10 days. And then I discover that the food plan is super restrictive. It's too restrictive. I'm getting burned out. I don't want to do the writing. And I'm hitting a wall. And then I fall back or I have a slip. And I think, what? I'm never going to get this. And I get discouraged. And so a lot of it is, you know, coming out of relapse, I haven't let go of control. I haven't let go of the food. I haven't let go of control of my program. And that, I think, is essential. Now, John Kay, who was here last year, I mean, he has great talks about relapse. I mean, he really has a fascinating approaches to relapse. And if you weren't here for that, go get one of his tapes, because he really does talk about the mindset of relapse. And one of the things that they used to talk about early in the program was the concept of 21 days of abstinence. If anyone who's been in here a long time, that was a big deal. And the reason it's fascinating is that, you know, if you go 21 days without sugar, your body stops craving it. That's where the 21 days comes from. You know, if you eat more protein and you have less sugar, your body's going to stop craving that sugar, and that need and that obsession for it really begins to go away at 21 days. And I think that there was some connection there between that 21 days of abstinence back then, when people began to sponsor people or do different things. Each group had their own thing. But I think there was a real connection there. And but, you know, there's this race to get back into, you know, into the game, so to speak, with relapse. And the fact is that the only race we have is against ourselves and our expectations. And I think part of it is that we have this idea of perfection that we haven't let go of. We couldn't reach that ideal. So, I can't do it, so let me just go. And then you get into, you know, binging and everything else, and you're out. And for me, my thing was, I kept gaining weight, coming to meetings, not having a sponsor, not talking about it. It was a secret. Well, it wasn't much of a secret. People could see I was getting heavy, and every once in a while someone would say, "Do you want to talk about this?" Like, no. Because I was angry at myself. And slowly I began to drift away. It's funny, in the program, you get these stories. I had this piano my grandfather had, and he was moving, and it was an old piano. it was up in San Francisco, and it really needed to be redone. So I looked in the phone book for piano restorers and tuners. I mean, this piano had to be completely redone. I see a guy, piano restoration. Call the guy. A guy named Jerry something. So I start talking to him. And at this point, I had not been going to meetings, and I gained weight. And I go, so I explained to him, I said, I got this piano, it's my grandfather's, and, you know, is it worth restoring? I mean, how much would it cost, you know, a couple thousand dollars? Isn't that less expensive than a new piano, and it's a baby grand, and da 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 da. And he goes, yeah, I'd love to help you, but I don't work with compulsive overeaters. I was like, what? Let me just say, Jerry B., in the program, he recognized my voice. I did not recognize his voice. And he goes, it's Jerry from OA. And I just like, oh my, I mean, he had me. And he goes, first off, don't restore the piano. It's not worth it. And he goes, how are you doing? And so we began talking, and I had no idea what he did for a living. I had no idea that that was him. And we had a good laugh, and I already had another piano, and I said, well, do you also do tuning? Come on over. And he'd come over and tune my piano. You know, and he'd say, are you going to meetings? And I go, no. And he goes, okay. Well, we miss you. When you're ready, come on back. And that's all he'd say. And you know, just his presence was so helpful. He didn't, like, do the hard sell, but he was there. About every 6 to 9 months, he'd come by, tune the piano, we'd talk a bit about music, and he was just there. So I knew when it was time, I could go back, I could see him, I could talk to him. You know, I ended up, in more recent years, sponsoring him. And, you know, I was angry with myself when I was out there in relapse. I was angry that I got heavy, I was angry at the program that somehow it didn't work, it didn't rescue me, and yet I was cutting myself off from people, so no one could reach out to help me. And trying to get back, you know, I gained the weight, I was very, you know, I just kept beating myself up. I got this health scare where I had to lose all this weight, and doing it with a crazy diet, and running, and, you know, I was resentful at myself. And I really thought I was resentful at OA because it didn't work. And when I came back, the realization coming back was the only time I didn't have a problem with weight was when I was abstinent in OA. It didn't fluctuate. I had the same clothing size. I didn't think about the food. I was healthy. You know, and I had to bring it back to looking at the positive aspects of the program and what program and abstinence did for me, not how it had failed me, in my view, and how I had failed myself. So a lot of my relapse thinking was really tied up in self-resentment and self-pity. And I'm going to say this about self-pity, and we're going to get into this in emotional. I thought for years I suffered from depression. I've taken depression medication for years. I don't take it any longer. I found for me, just me, not everybody else, that a lot of my depression is really self-pity. Very, very, very similar in how it manifests itself. And when I started addressing the self-pity, the depression lifted. That's just me. So with the relapse, you know, the most important thing I could do was get somebody else, a sponsor. And that sponsor was not going to be anything magic. And it's going to be very resistant. And it was a very loose abstinence, just no sugar. And you know what? That was really hard. And I certainly did not do it perfectly at first. And I had slips. And he goes, okay. And I go, well, do I start my abstinence time all over again? He goes, no. He goes, the tools are here to help you recover. They're not here to act as a whip. Shorten the whip. Stop beating yourself up with the tools of the program. You're never going to get abstinent if you do that. But do you have an honest desire to get abstinent? Yes, I do. Okay. So you had a little slip. Done. Move on. Don't dwell on it. It's not about being perfect here. It's about working towards an ideal. And so having a sponsor like that It was extremely helpful to get back on track. And I also knew if I could get 21 days without eating sugar, the craving and the desire for the sugar would go away. And so when I'm sitting there going, oh, there's a candy bar. Well, that means I'm going to have to start 21 days of just this obsession. Let me let it go. And I used a little trick, and I passed it on to my sponsees, and it goes, I'm going to have that candy bar tomorrow. I'm going to have that ice cream tomorrow. I didn't deny myself. I just wasn't going to have it today. And so when tomorrow came, the obsession was not there. Sometimes I even forgot about it. And other times it would still be there, and I'd go, okay, I'm not going to have it today. I'm going to have it tomorrow. But I can have it. The door is open. See, the thing is, coming back from relapse, it's all the stuff I was going to give up. How could I give that stuff up? Instead of, what am I going to gain? And how this stuff is killing me. So instead, I'm giving nothing up. I'm just not having that stuff today. And really, that's all of what it's about, is today. And I've done that with other sponsees where I go, okay, so tell you what, why don't you have that stuff tomorrow? And let's talk tomorrow before you have it, just to make sure you really want to go through with it. And if you do, that's cool. I'm not going to stop you. Never has it happened where they then call me up and say, okay, I'm going for the cake. I'll talk to you later. It doesn't happen. Because it's so much in the moment, that anxiety in the moment of, let me have this quick fix now, and the lie is, I'll feel better. And I feel better for about 30 seconds to 10 minutes. And then I'm like, okay, that was really stupid. And I really feel like crap now. Okay, let me have it, go have another piece. Because I might as well go for broke. And I also had this magical thinking. This is the other thing, magical thinking that I play around with. It's like after two pints, like a pint of ice cream, the second pint somehow, the calories, it would like overflow. The calories, you know, water coming out of it, they wouldn't count. They would just sort of sweat off, and I could have it, and it really wouldn't affect my body. And the reality of it is it did count. But somehow my magical thinking was, well, you know, the first pint, that's where all the damage is done. The second pint, no, it's not going to really affect me, so why don't I just have two pints of ice cream with syrup? And, you know, and I did engage in that magical thinking. Or I can have some now, and it's okay. And I play the games that we all play. And again, that's that magical thinking that once I have X, then I'll feel better, it will be better, whatever the case may be. It's the idea that something outside will fix me, and then it will be better. And that's true of anything. So, is this ice cream going to fix me? No, but I'm going to really enjoy it while I have it. And then what? I hate it when I had a sponsor who used to say to me all the time, and then what? I go, what do you mean, and then what? He goes, well, then what? You've done this. It's done. Now what? You've created a mess on your hands. What happens next? I go, I don't know. Well, think about it, because that's what life becomes, is your consequences. So a lot of times, I think that I have to think that food through. So I have to think about, okay, I'm going to go have this incredible, you know, I'm going to kill the buffet table. And then what? What happens next? Does my life get better? No. You wanted all that food? Yeah. What does it solve? Nothing. Am I going to feel good tomorrow? No. And that's usually why I'm like, just shut up. You know, just be quiet. No. But that's the thing. It's like, and then what? So I use these little tricks tomorrow, and then what? And know that if I get to 21 days without sugar, then the craving for that really, really disappears. And all I have to think about is right now, today, this minute. And because for me, so much of my disease is tied up in globalization of thought. This is happening now. It's going to be bad forever.
Yeah.
This is going on. The rest of the world is crap. oh, they're having this controversy in this thing, oh my God, the country is going to hell. No, they're having a little controversy here. This is very normal. This is what happens. People have disagreements. They don't always act so good. That's life. That's not a, you know, I'm always looking for these signs to explain things. I look for signs to explain my recovery. I look for signs. Well, if this happens, then I know it's meant to be. No, I don't. If this happens, this happens. And then I just continue with my day as I'm supposed to. There are no, you know, God is not setting out. God does have signs. God does have miracles, these coincidences that happen. If I'm in the spiritual stream of things, I do see them. But they're not guideposts. They're not signs of, okay, now this is going to happen and things are going to be wonderful. Because I do that and I go, oh, this happened. This is a sign from my higher power. I got this job. Everything's going to be good. It's going to be great. I think it's going to go wonderful. And then a week later, you know, my car breaks down and I go, oh, my higher power screwed me over again. All the money that I got from this new job is now going to this car and I'm back to where I was. Well, the higher power had nothing to do with that. The car broke down. That's life. Everyone's car breaks down at some point. It's not. But I had this idea that this thing happens and then somehow it represents or signifies things. So I'm sort of emphasizing and interpreting how God is acting in my world, and that's really a big mistake. Because sometimes the worst thing in the world can happen is really what God needs to have happen for me to move me off wherever I am into another direction. I see it as a setback. I see it as getting fired. I see it as something terrible. But the reality of it is that it's probably God's will. As I said, everything happening in front of me is God's will. I just, my job is to accept it. And, you know, the other thing is that I get abstinent, and somehow, especially in early abstinence, I think that all of a sudden, no problem should happen. You know, I got abstinent. You know, and then this thing happened. How does God expect me to be abstinent when, you know, I'm just like 3 days abstinent and this thing blows up in my face? You know, and it's like, no, that's not how it works. I'm abstinent and this thing happened. And maybe, and I'll survive it. But, you know, for me, I'm always, probably in the first 2 months coming off of relapse, I have 1 foot out the door. I just need that excuse. I just need that excuse. Because I, you know, the disease is very, very powerful. And if I entertain it, it's going to become more powerful. You know, before I binge, it always begins long. The binge always is planned long in advance. Looking a little bit longingly at the cookbook or the, you know, the cook magazine of the desserts. Wow. I'd really, well, I can't have that, but that would be good. Is that saying, yeah, looks good. Really dwell on it for a while. Or planning a vacation and picking the restaurants first and then the destinations. Oh, well, I'll go here, and then we'll go to that Disney, and then I can go, oh, I love that stuff. That, you know. Is that really recovery? No. So I have to say, I'm going to go on this vacation, and yeah, I want to go to a couple of nice places, but does that have to be the focus? So, you know, I can really see how I'm planning my relapse months in advance, and I have the choice to say, call my sponsor and say, hey, you know what, I'm going to go on this vacation, but I'm planning all the restaurants and food stops first instead of, you know, going on a vacation. Let's talk about it. And I get it out there. My secret is out. And then I'm willing to work on recovery, as opposed to being secret about it. And then, well, I was on vacation. I lost my abstinence on vacation. I can tell you, when I lived in Paris and in OA, how many people came to Paris and lost their abstinence? And I said, so what happened? Well, I went to this store, and he just had all this like chocolate and stuff, and it was amazing, and I couldn't believe it. And I go, okay, don't walk in the store. Well, you know, it's Fouchon's, and I mean, it's just this amazing place, and everyone said you had to go there. I go, yeah. Can you eat anything in there from your abstinence? Well, you know, not really, but I go, so don't walk in. Don't entertain it. Don't romance it. You know, there are certain places I can't go. And that's okay. There's a place in Portland with the donuts. So, you know, oh, you got to go check that out. I'm like, I don't eat donuts. Why? You going to sightsee? Oh, that does look good. No. No, because that stuff is powerful. Because they'll be like, well, you know, in Portland, no one knows. It's one day. It's just one. You know, and I'm sure it's good. It's like, no, I can't entertain it. I can't do that. There are certain things I have to say no. And that's keeping myself safe, and that's self-care. So, you know, in terms of relapse, you know, when I came back, it was, you know, I had to, I was not willing, and I understood that. And when people are coming back, they're not willing. They want to be willing. But the willingness is like exercise. It's like it's building a muscle again. You know, it's not there naturally. Willingness is not there naturally. So I have to do all that stuff to support the willingness to become abstinent and to stay abstinent. And then once I get abstinent and something happens, I think, oh, great, I got abstinent. Then this stuff happened. You know, come on, God, give me a break. And I had a sponsor who actually relapse after this. But I never forget what he said. I did my first fifth step with him. And he said, after the first miracle, it's rude to doubt. And I thought about that. And it's like, yeah, if I'm being relieved of this obsession that was just, I had no control over, and it was ruining my life, and I'm relieved of that obsession, and there's a miracle that takes place there, why am I going to sit there in doubt that I'm not going to be taken care of the next time there's something insurmountable facing me? Why am I going to doubt that? And yet I do. And so a lot of times I have to, you know, have this situation where, you know, something happens and I go, okay, it's going to be fine. It's rude to doubt that I'm not going to be taken care of. I can have this obsession of food lifted, but I can't have this other stuff taken care of. You know, I can have you know, whatever it is, the obsession of spending, lifted, drinking, lifted. But this other stuff? Now, it doesn't mean it's going to be taken care of the way I want it to be taken care of. If there's a resolution that may not really fit my definition of a resolution, but I will be personally taken care of. And that's another thing, too, when there's a lot of chaos going on. And it seems like today there's a lot of chaos going on in the world. And, you know, on Monday, my boss got fired. And this is a guy that hired me 25 years ago. And he became my direct boss again about 4 or 5 years ago. And it wasn't a complete surprise, but it was a surprise. And people are like, oh, my God, it's terrible. And I'd say, you didn't get fired. I didn't get fired. He got fired. It didn't happen to us. And I have to remember a lot of times, I want to take in that stuff that's happening to other people, or it's happening to a loved one. A loved one is sick and it is devastating, especially a child. It's not happening to me. I think it's happening to me and God's doing it to me. No, this is what's happening. It's not happening to me. So maybe I can be of assistance if I'm not totally in my head. So when this guy got fired, I was sad, but it really doesn't affect me when I think about it. And so it clears away and all the chaos going on, saying, well, is that happening to me right now? No. Okay, do I need to feed into that and get into the turmoil of all of that? Because the only thing that's going to relieve that turmoil is a burrito grande. You know? And that's where my mind goes. So I have to say, no, that really doesn't affect me. So I have to be, and I don't go see a lot of movies. Because when I go to movies, for me, I just dive right into the movie. That's reality for me. I have a very difficult time separating what's going on the screen from reality, and I'm in it. And so there are subject matters or things where I'm going to go, I'm not going to go see that. It's going to impact me too much. You know, I'm very careful about what I watch on television. You know, my wife loves watching TV, and she binge watches all the Netflix stuff, and some of it's pretty good. And I go, I have to watch stupid comedy. That's it. She goes, well, you're hiding from life. you know, if you watch this hard-hitting documentary about, you know, this, and it's really, you need to know what's going on. I go, I know what's going on. I don't need to be reminded of that. I go, here's the thing. You know, I'm going to watch a TV show, and it's, you know, cops and robbers and stuff, and it's about bad people. There's enough bad things in the world. I don't need to bring that in. I'm very selective about what I bring into my mind because I begin globalizing and thinking that's the way the world is, and this is the way it is, and for me, and this is this terrible, and I start taking in a lot of things that aren't happening to me but are happening into the world, and I need a lot of food to cope with that. So I just say, sorry, I don't want to watch that, and it just drives her crazy. And I go, but I'll watch something dumb and funny and entertaining, and that's just where I am for the next couple of years. And have been for a couple of years. Because I have to be careful. I don't have to sign in and sign up for all the stuff that's going on because I'm going to take it over. I'm a people pleaser. I'm a fixer. I want to do all of that stuff. And the reality is I can't fix other people. I can't fix other things. I can't people please. And then when it doesn't turn out my way or that person isn't doing what I know that they need to do, and if they just did it, their life would be so much better. And then, oh, okay, let me go get that burrito, you know. And I eat over it. And what does that burrito do for them? Nothing. What does it do for me? Not good stuff. You know? So I have to be careful. And I have to be careful about what I let in. I have to be very, very protective. And we can see people very, very protective of their programs and their food plans, but the relationships that they allow into their lives are the things that they're very unprotective. And that's the thing that gets them. So I have to sort of become very protective about what I allow into my mind, because what happens in my mind, in my thinking, is going to manifest itself on the plate. And some people call it copping out. I mean, I work with the news coming at me 24 hours a day. I have to know exactly what's going on. I work in the world of investments, and people want to know, oh, well, what's happening? What's happening here? Is it the tariffs? Is this going to happen? So, you know, I just avoid everything political. Really hard to do in my job, you know, because politics affects things. But it's fascinating. If I don't pay attention to it, really, the reality of it is, I'm fine. It doesn't hurt my analysis. And I tell my clients, now, whenever there's anything with on the news dealing, whether it's about the president, for the president, against the president, I don't watch it. It's irrelevant. How can that be irrelevant? I go, easy. What the president does doesn't affect who goes to Starbucks. You know? At the end of the day, that's what it comes down to. So, for me, I have to be very careful about what I allow in. That's me. And it doesn't mean that I have to be apolitical. It means I have to say, I have to walk away from the chaos. I have to walk away from situations. You know, when my wife and daughter are getting into it together, I want to jump in and say, come on, guys, let's, you know, I have a 13-year-old daughter. You know, it's like, you know, and, you know, her and my wife get into it like nobody's business. And I'm like, okay, yeah, stop yelling, but calm down. It's this. She's just trying to help you make dinner, and you're trying to tell her what to do. I understand it. You know, I just let it all blow up, let it happen, stay out of it, and then maybe I'll go talk to my daughter a little bit going on, saying, so what happened? And she'll be, well, you know, she was doing this and doing that, and I can't believe it, you know, she's treating me like a 3-year-old, and no. Okay. So, what if you did something different? How would you feel? And I don't know what that doing something different is. And just see if maybe I can calm her down afterwards. Not fix it, but certainly not get in the middle of it and get into that chaos. Because those all become reasons to eat. You know, at the end of the day, I have to really be careful about the situations I put myself in and not try and fix other people or fix the world. Doesn't mean I'm not engaged. I'm involved in a lot of nonprofits. I'm involved in a lot of activities and movements, and I devote a lot of time outside of work to those things that I really believe in and those causes, and I can do them 1,000%. And so I'm not saying hide under a rock, by no means. You know, I sit on 2 or 3 different nonprofit boards. So I'm very, very engaged, but I'm very careful about what I allow in because I have a disability. I have a disability that other people don't have. When I came into the program and I was very new, I'd be like, you know, most people, if they want a glass of orange juice, they pour a glass of orange juice, and that's it. Me, I got to go plant the tree, prune it, let it grow, pick it. I got to do all these steps to get the same thing that someone who doesn't have this problem can have in an instant. And it's unfair. Why? Why do I have to do all these inventories? Why do I have to go to these meetings? Why do I have to have a sponsor? Why do I have to work these steps? Why do I have to have a food plan and call it in? And how come I can't have this and can't have that? My sponsor says, because you're a compulsive overeater. Sorry. Well, these other people don't have it, their lives are fine, and they can just go on and do whatever, and it really sucks. Yeah. And I was really resentful. But I have to realize I've got a disability. I have to do all of this stuff to live a normal life. They don't. Okay. But that's the price that has to be paid. But if I do all that stuff, not only do I have a normal life, I have a spectacular life. But I have to let go and say, yeah, I have a disability. I have to do all this other extra stuff that these folks don't have to do. And sometimes that also means limiting what I allow into my life and being very careful. And that also includes some sponsees. We all had them, that phone call. Oh, do I really want to talk to this person? Yes, I'm going to be of service. But there are times when there are people who are toxic who do not want to get better, but they want to use me as a lay therapist. And there's this and that. And they're, oh, you cannot believe it. And I have to say, I'm not a therapist. So tell you what, let's get into the steps here. And I bet you we can get to the bottom of this problem with a little bit of step work. And that's a great way to get rid of someone. That's the secret. You know, because a lot of us would like to sit here and complain. I know I do. Solution? I love being a victim. I love self-pity. It's a very pure emotion. I don't deserve love, but I'll take self-pity. Because I don't deserve love. I deserve self-pity. Well, the reality of it is I'll set up situations where I can have that self-pity in abundance. And I can view through a prism of self-pity things that happen to me. Those things happen. They don't happen to me. They happen. I may be involved, but since I have the steps and the program and a food plan, I can decide how I'm going to react to that situation. When I'm in the food and I'm in relapse, I don't have that choice. I gotta react. Because that gives me one more reason to go back to the food. Everything's about going back to the food when I'm in relapse. That is my only solace and comfort, but it's not a comfort for very long, so I constantly have to go back to it, so I have to break the cycle. And the other thing I have to remember is there's no special occasions. See, that's what got me so often in the beginning. It's your birthday. You're getting married. Wedding cake. Come on. You know, all of that special occasion. Well, it's just this once. Every day is a special occasion in my book. You know, I see that thing. Well, you know, I'm only going to be here once, and they only make it here, so I might as well have it because, you know, have the experience. And there are no special occasions. You know, if there are no special occasions and every day is a miracle and I have a chance to live it, great. But when there's a special occasion, that allows me to sort of go off the plan and have a little something. And what I'm really doing is creating a setup for a relapse or not allowing myself to get out of that relapse. So there are no special occasions, you know. And that, I think, is, you know, so for me, I'm Italian. My mother's Italian. So, like, birthdays, you know. Gift giving. It's like paying tribute to the mafia, you know. You're going to really go all out on a birthday or a holiday, and, you know, how much you do for someone is how much you love them, and it really shows through. And it seems to be an Italian thing, or at least in my family it is, with the Italian side of the family. And so when my birthday comes around, it's got to be a big deal. You know, it's got to be the meal and the celebration. And it's like, no. It's another day. Yes, it's a great, it's a nice day. It's my birthday, but it's another day. There's no special occasion. You know, instead, when I turned 50, I said, okay, what am I going to do? I saw a client of mine. She has a blog, and she had gone to Venice to run the Venice Marathon, which was in October when my birthday is. And I thought, how can you have a marathon in Venice? It's all islands. How can you get 26 miles in there? And so I sort of looked into it, and yeah, they do have a marathon. And I figured, wow. And they built a special bridge over the Grand Canal. So it was like, the only time you get to walk on water on this marathon. And then they closed down St. Mark's Square, and you run through the square. And I thought, okay, well, I'm running marathons. I said, this could be pretty spectacular. So for my 50th birthday, I went to Venice, and I ran the marathon. And I mean, it was tough. You know, the time change was like, whoa. But it was quite an experience. And I had a great time. And so for me, the shift, there was a shift into what's everybody going to do for me. It's like, no one's going to plan this trip. I'm the one in the family that plans all the trips. So I'm just like, okay, this is where I'm going. I signed up, got a thing on Airbnb, and worked it all out and did all this. And I did it all. And I had a great time. And it was a great experience. It wasn't about my old ideas of how a special occasion should be. And so I try and think about that, you know, whenever some food item is presented to me or something else, or if people aren't paying enough attention to me, you know, in such a way, or celebrating the fact, you know, the kids are not doing enough for me and saying how much they love me or this, that, and the other. You know, they're just like, hey, can I have 20 bucks? Okay, come on, please. You know, they're waiting for me. I want to go to the movie. Now it's like 40 bucks. But, you know, I don't have to focus in on that. And I don't have to look for the special occasion. And I think the special occasion mentality was what really tripped me up with the relapse. It's just another day. And it can, and every day can be special. And I can think about, okay, what is so great about today? And it gets me into a place of gratitude. And it's really hard to binge and be grateful at the same time. It really is. You know, because if I'm really super grateful and feeling good about things, if I'm really honest, I'm not going to want that stuff. And so getting into that attitude of gratitude, which we'll get into in the emotional part of the recovery. Is there anything in relapse I didn't cover? We've got about 10 minutes left. Yeah. Sure. So the question is, what is my experience with anger, which often, in your case, leads to relapse, and how do I handle that? So, you know, I get a piece of bad news or something happens that really upsets me. How do I handle that? So, the other day, I got my credit card bill, and there was a pretty large charge on it. This store, I knew my wife would have been at that store. She's got a spending issue. And I was like, I cannot believe it. And she basically went and took my daughter and her friends to this store and bought up all the stuff for her friends, and her parents were going to give her money to pay them back. So I'm like, one, it was a lot more money she spent than I thought, and two, I certainly didn't see that money that the parents of my daughter's friends gave to her, and yet I got to pay this large bill. And I was so upset. And I'm like, but we've had spending fights for 25 years. This has not gotten better at all. So I call my sponsor and say, okay, I am out of my mind with anger and sadness and disappointment. What do I do? Because, you know, after, because I was going to the gym, work out with my trainer, and then I was going to go pick up some dinner, and it could be a pretty big dinner. And he goes, and I go, I want to do something different. I don't want to be in this merry-go-round, so I'm not going to talk to her about this. I'm not going to bring it up. Why? She's very consistent in her behavior. And he goes, yeah, so love her. Don't be passive-aggressive. Love her. Do something different. She's not changing. She will do this again in about 4 months. And so I was like, okay, and I really thought about, why did I get so angry? So I got angry because, you know, I'm resentful at her for spending this. But really, the character, you know, he goes, what's happening in me that's causing me to be upset? When I'm disturbed by someone else's actions, it's because there's something wrong with me. He goes, she's not the problem. You are. Like, this is not how sponsors are supposed to act, but okay. But he was right. So what I discovered was, what are the character defects? You know, one, that's less money that I thought I could spend on something else that I wanted to do. And I get fearful financial insecurity. I'm not trusting in God that there's going to be enough money there. You know? She did it to me. No, she didn't. She wanted to go out and get this stuff for my daughter and her friends, and she took the money back, and yeah, she knew what she was doing, you know. Because I'm like, here's a budget. This is what we can spend. If you want to buy and do all this other stuff and this travel, this is what you need to spend this month. And if you go beyond that, that means we can't do that other stuff. Make sense? Yeah, makes sense. Okay, I think I got the sign-off on that, and we're good. Well, apparently not. That's just the way she is. So I can leave her. That's an option. I don't want to do that. So I have to do something else. I have to accept it, not be resentful about it, and see, why does it keep pissing me off? I can't control it. And it's the fear that somehow there's not going to be enough there. So that way, that's what it comes back to. And I have to do something different and love her and not bring it up. So I got home. I'm like, how's your day? What's going on? You know, what's been happening? Oh, I didn't have a good day. So tell me about it. What's happening? You know, instead of saying, hey. And then going up and going to the other side of the house and ignoring everybody. And the desire to really go and get that big dinner was not there. Because what I saw was, comes back to fear, control, not having enough, not trusting in God. And whenever I'm disturbed, it's me that's the problem. Someone else, a speaker, said, whenever I get offended, because everyone's offended today, when I get offended by what some other person or group says about me or to me, it's me. I'm the problem, not them. I've chosen to become offended. Why? What is it in me that's bringing up that negative reaction? I don't have to react to it. So, with her, that's really what I had to do. So when I get that anger, and I will eat over things with other people, if I have that sort of spiritual space, I'll try and make a phone call, or I'll think about, I know what my sponsor's going to say. I mean, I've been working with him long enough, I know what he's going to say. I'm like, okay. So I imagine the phone call, hey, so this is what's going on, and he goes, okay, so, you know, turn it over. You can't change them. You can either, you know, change your actions or change your thoughts. And what is it about you that's making you so pissed off? You're the problem, not them. See, here's the thing. If they're the problem and she's going to keep doing it, I'm captive. I'm captive. I have no control. I'm stuck. Whatever the situation may be. Same with work. If I don't like it, I can leave. If I don't like the way they're treating me at work, I can go get a job somewhere else. I can do that in my profession. You know, instead, or play the victim, or turn it over and say, okay, why did this really affect me? You know, what is it, the thing that's, you know, financial insecurity, not having control, ego, they didn't listen to me, they didn't take my, you know, what I brought up in that meeting into consideration, they just forgot about everything I said, and they're not going to consider that at all. Okay, that's fine, they're the boss, I'm not. It's their company, not mine. So I can let that go because it's my ego. Then, I have control. I'm the one who has power. And that's really what it comes down to in the world. If I'm going to sit there and rage and complain because life is unfair, I'm always a victim. I always have to react to whatever happens to me. I can take no positive action because I'm reacting. Whereas the world will do what it's going to do. It's not impacting me per se. It can, but I get to choose how I'm going to react. Suddenly, I have the power to decide how I want to handle that situation. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy or pretty or look good, but I can choose that today. And then I'm no longer a victim, you know, just going from one crisis to the other. And how does this happen to me? This isn't fair. As we say down in LA, well, the fair is in Pomona. That's where the county fair is. If you want fair, go to Pomona. And so that is how I deal with the anger and really find out what's happening inside. And it will help me, you know, and I tell you this, people know me, this financial thing has been a huge issue. It ain't changing. It's never going to change, ever. So I got to decide on a daily basis, do I stick around? Are all the other aspects of our relationship outweigh this? Or, no, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to leave. I get to make that decision. So, and if I make the decision to stay, stop playing, you know, victim. Oh, poor me, this is terrible. No, I've made a very positive, active decision. Live with it. Be comfortable with it. Be happy. That's choice.